Penguin Random House Audio presents The Singapore Grip by J.G. Farrell. Read for you by Mike Grady.
Part 1. Chapter 1. The city of Singapore was not built up gradually, the way most cities are, by a natural deposit of commerce on the banks of some river, or at a traditional confluence of trade routes. It was simply invented one morning early in the 19th century by a man looking at a map. Here, he said to himself, is where we must have a city, halfway between India and China. This will be the great halting place on the trade route to the Far East. Mind you, the Dutch will dislike it, and Penang won't be pleased, not to mention Malacca. This man's name was Sir Thomas Stamford Raffles. Before the war, his bronze statue used to stand in Empress Place, in a stone alcove like a scallop shell. He has been moved along now, and, turned to stone, occupies a shady spot by the river. He was by no means the lantern-jawed individual you might have expected, indeed, a rather vague-looking man in a frock coat. Although people had once lived there, the island of Singapore, when he arrived, was largely deserted except for a prodigious quantity of rats and centipedes. Rather ominously, Raffles also noticed a great many human skulls and bones, the droppings of local pirates. He wasted no time, however, in negotiating for the island with an alarmed native, and then proceeded, his biographer tells us, to set up a flagpole 36 feet high. "Our object," he wrote in a letter to a friend, "is not territory, but trade, a great commercial emporium and a fulcrum, whence we may extend our influence politically as circumstances may hereafter require." As he stood there, on that lonely beach, and gazed up at the flag with rats and centipedes seething and tumbling over his shoes, did Raffles foresee the prosperity which lay ahead for Singapore? Undoubtedly, he did. When you think of the city as it was 40 years ago, you should not imagine an uncivilized frontier town of the jungle. You had only to stroll around the center of the city, with its wide avenues and lawns, and look at the monolithic government buildings, at the luxurious department stores, and at the marmoreal dignity of the banks, to realize that Singapore was the work of a great and civilized nation. True, there were other parts of the city, the various native quarters where Tamils, Malays, and above all the Chinese lived, which were rather less imposing. There, in those lower depths, Chinese secret societies undoubtedly performed monstrous crimes, kidnapped their own prominent citizens, fought out appalling territorial battles, stunned themselves with drugs, and so forth. If you were merely a visitor, a sailor, say, in those years before the war, Singapore would undoubtedly have seemed no less tawdry, no less exciting than another of the great eastern seaports. You would have gone to drink and dance at one of the amusement parks, perhaps even at the Great World itself, whose dance hall, a vast echoing barn of a place, had for many years entertained lonely sailors like yourself. There, for 25 cents, you could dance with the most beautiful taxi girls in the East, listen to the loudest bands, and admire the glorious dragons painted on the walls. In the good old days, before the troops started flooding in at the beginning of the war, that place could swallow an entire ship's company and still seem empty, except for you and the 2 or 3 Chinese girls with dolls-painted faces sitting at your table, ready to support you with tiny but firm hands should you look like plunging to the floor full of tiger beer. There, too, when you staggered outside into the sweltering night, you would have been able to inhale that incomparable smell of incense, of warm skin, of meat cooking in coconut oil, of money and frangipani, and hair oil, and lust, and sandalwood, and heaven knows what, a perfume like the breath of life itself. And from the roof of the Seamen's Institute, or from some other less respectable roof, you might have seen the huge purple sign advertising Tiger Balm, and beside it, once darkness had completely fallen, its guardian, the great saber-toothed tiger with glowing orange stripes beginning its nightly prowl over the sleeping roofs of Singapore. But there is no denying it, certain parts of the city were tawdry and others were wretched, and becoming more so as the age advanced. Already, by 1940, the walls of cheap hotels and boarding houses, hitherto impermeable except to an occasional muffled groan or sigh, were becoming porous and beginning to leak radio music, twangings of guitars and news bulletins. Every great city has its seamy side, and so let us look for preference at the gentler parts of the city, at the elegant European suburb of Tanglin, for instance, where Walter Blackett, chairman of the illustrious merchant and agency house of Blackett and Webb Limited, lived with his family. At first glance, Tanglin resembled any quiet European suburb, with its winding, tree-lined streets and pleasant bungalows. There was a golf course close at hand, with quite respectable greens. Numerous tennis courts could be seen on the other side of sweet-smelling hedges, and even a swimming pool or two. It was a peaceful and leisurely life that people lived here on the whole. Yet, if you looked more closely, you would see that it was a suburb ready to burst at the seams, with a dreadful tropical energy. Foliage sprang up on every hand with a determination unknown to our own polite European vegetation. Dark, glistening green was smeared over everything, as if with a palette knife, while in the gloom, the jungle tends to be gloomy, something sinister which had been making a noise a little while ago was now holding its breath. If you left your bungalow unattended for a few months while you went home on leave, very likely you would come back to find that green lariats had been thrown over every projecting part and were wrestling it to the ground, that powerful ferns were drilling their way between its bricks, or that voracious house-eating insects, which were really nothing more than sharp jaws mounted on legs, had been making meals of the woodwork. Moreover, the mosquitoes in this particular suburb were only distant cousins of the mild insects which irritate us on an English summer evening. In Tanglin, you had to face the dreaded Anopheles variety, each a tiny flying hypodermic syringe containing a deadly dose of malaria. And if, by good fortune, you managed to avoid malaria, there was still another mosquito waiting in the wings, this one clad in striped football socks, ready to inject you with dengue fever. If your child fell over while playing in the garden and cut its knee, you had better make sure that no fly was allowed to settle on the wound. Otherwise, within a day or two, you would find yourself picking tiny white maggots out of it with tweezers. At that time, when parts of the suburb were still bordered by jungle, it was by no means uncommon for monkeys, snakes, and such like to visit your garden with the idea of picking your fruit, or swallowing your mice, or even your puppy, if you had an appetizing one. But all I mean to suggest is that, besides the usual comforts of suburban life, there were certain disadvantages too. Not far from where the Blacketts lived, Orchard Road sloped gently down, a gradient that was more psychological than real, almost straight for a mile or so, until it lost itself on the fringes of Chinatown and the commercial city where Walter had his headquarters on Collier Quay and did battle on weekdays. Down there in the city, taking the place of the rats and the centipedes, which had once made it their home, seething, devouring, copulating, businesses rose and fell, sank their teeth into each other, swallowed, broke away, gulped down other firms, or mounted each other to procreate smaller companies, just as they do elsewhere in other great capitalist cities. But up here in Tanglin, people moved in a quiet and orderly way about their daily affairs, apparently detached from these sordid encounters, detached especially from the densely packed native masses below. And yet they moved, one might suppose, as the hands of a clock move. Imagine a clock in a glass case. The hands move unruffled about their business, but at the same time we can see the working of springs and wheels and cogs. That ordered life in Tanglin, depended in the same way.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?